91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This afternoon, we profile the mayor of the city of South Miami, Dr. Philip Stoddard. He was recently reelected to a fourth term in the suburban city of some 12,000 residents. Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Dr. Stoddard is a professor of biology at Florida International University. He's taken strong stances and garnered national news coverage on clean energy production and rising sea levels. He's particularly critical of FPL and its political contributions to Florida legislators and its operation of the Turkey Point nuclear facility. He's derided Miami-Dade mosquito control efforts against the Zika virus as well. We'll return with South Miami Mayor Dr. Philip Stoddard after NPR and regional news.
Seven minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Today we visit with the City of South Miami Mayor, Dr. Philip Stoddard. He's a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Florida International University. He's a zoologist and the author of some 60 scientific publications.
Mayor Stoddard recently won re-election with a 53% of the city's vote. He's campaigned on the decrease in South Miami crime and touts an increase in the city's funding reserves, but it's on the environmental side that Mayor Stoddard makes most of his news.
He's a staunch critic of FPL and a big proponent of solar power, and he sees rising sea levels as much more than a future threat. Welcome to you, Mayor Philip Stoddard. Good to have you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you.
And I had no idea what you looked like until today.
Sorry to disappoint.
All the listeners need to look up Bonnie Berman and see what she actually looks like.
Oh, my. No, don't.
Hopefully they get the hair.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Thank you. Well, I wouldn't want to know you as one who were immersed in the world of academia, why you wanted to run for public office and why mayor?
I didn't.
Ah.
My neighbor snookered me into it. I went over to someone's house to find out who the next mayoral candidate would be and discovered it was me.
Truly?
Absolutely. And I said I couldn't possibly do this if my wife wasn't on board. And they were out of the house like a shot. And an hour later, in comes my wife saying, Phil, think of what we could do.
Was it really more the Turkey Point transmission lines that really prompted you to get into politics?
No, that's what prompted my neighbors to get me into politics. But yes, in a way.
So truly, you didn't have aspirations. You didn't want to run for office. You said that running for office is hell.
Well, I have the best job in the world as a professor. I get to think about what I want to think about. I get to work with young people. I get to write interesting things. I get to solve puzzles and problems. I mean, what a great job for somebody like me. And politics is different. I do like learning. And so it's been a wonderful opportunity to learn about a whole lot of things I didn't know about before. Urban planning, law, how cities work.
Or don't. Let me ask you, some of us have notions. If I was in office, if I was a mayor, did you ever have any thoughts like that, that if you were the mayor, what you would do? And how different from that is being mayor, if you had those thoughts?
I guess my wife had that thought.
She can't be here, though, right?
But I thought about the same things before I said yes. And that's why I agreed to do it. Otherwise, they couldn't have tortured me into doing it. And so what's different about it from what you think, and I think probably most branches of office would tell you the same thing, and that is that you may have the greatest idea in the world, but people don't do any old thing because it happens to be a good idea. I often say South Miami is a very progressive city unless you want to change something. And there's significant truth to it. People want everybody else to change, but they don't want to change themselves.
Give us an example of something you would like to change that you haven't been able to.
Well, first I'll give you an example of something I did change, and it was a very small thing. I said people ought to be able to sell homegrown fruit in front of their houses.
Okay.
Can you imagine anybody being opposed to this? Well, my gosh, citizens came in. The world's going to end if we do this. Imagine what the neighborhoods will look like if people are out there selling mangoes, and how do you know it's their mangoes, and on and on. I finally managed to convince my colleagues to enact this ordinance. And, you know, lo and behold, the world didn't end. Kids sell smoothies in front of their house in the summertime, and it's really nice. But it's just little things like this. The thing I've had the most difficulty with has been affordable housing. And the reason is that one has to... I mean, affordable housing doesn't pay for itself. That's why it's affordable. And, you know, land prices being what they are, you have to somehow provide financial incentives to somebody to construct and keep the rents affordable. Otherwise, they can't afford to do it. And so those incentives often come in the form of bonuses where you let them build extra units on a multifamily development so it has greater height and density. That's pretty typical. So if you want to do 10 extra affordable units, we're not going to count that against your total. And I got zero votes of support for that. And I think that to me has been the most frustrating thing, has been the difficulty of enacting best practices for promotion of affordable housing in South Miami.
The scientist as politician, are you comfortable with so many intangibles in the politics, the compromise and the inexactness?
It's a human business, and people are inexact. I also took multivariate statistics in graduate school, so I have numeric methods for dealing with both uncertainty and multiple variables. I was stuck in an airport one day, so I took all the voting records for my city commission and programmed them into the computer and did a what's called a multidimensional scaling analysis of people's voting. And it was very interesting. I made this nice map of how everybody voted, except for my wonderful colleague, Bob Welsh, and he required his own dimension to incorporate.
Why Bob, is that?
Well, Bob's a unique guy, and he sees the world and thinks about the world a little differently from anybody else. And so he could not be incorporated in a two-dimensional world. We needed an extra dimension for Bob.
That's a compliment. Is it?
I think Bob would take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
He knows about this.
Can we talk about your childhood a little? I was wondering, were you a nonconformist as a kid?
Yeah, I set a booby trap for the tooth fairy. No, I did. It wasn't a booby trap. Actually, I did that later on. And amazingly, the tooth fairy was clever enough to get around it. But I think I saw the world my own way.
You grew up in the Washington, D.C. area. How about some recollections of childhood, your education, hobbies, and things?
Well, I remember my mom taking me down to the marches, the civil rights marches on the mall. So I don't think I saw Martin Luther King, but I believe I heard him. And we used to take lots of walks in Rock Creek Park. My parents liked to watch birds. I thought that was boring. I was much more interested in snakes. But when I was young, in the dynamics of my school class, I had a friend who's still a friend who was always the leader, and I was always the ideas person. So I would come up with some idea, and he would be the leader who would get everybody excited about it and get them to carry it out.
That's interesting.
So
your father died when you were quite young.
Yeah.
When you were an infant.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was your grandfather who was in large part responsible for mentoring you or raising you?
Well, my grandfather helped my mom and me survive financially, which was very helpful. He got my mom gave her money to buy a car. And my grandfather had worked to get Jews out of Europe before World War II and had started the Jewish Welfare Board and so forth. And so my mom was not about to buy a Volkswagen Beetle, which had been built with slave labor during the war. And so she bought a British Ford, and it was the worst car ever built. And this thing always died. You could count on it to stop working. And this very nice man, Ted Stoddard, helped us get the car started one morning when I was about 4 years old. He lived in the same apartment building as we did. And so I remember asking my mom, when are we going to see the nice man again? And so that he became my stepfather. Nice. But my grandfather scooped my stepfather up as part of the family as well. And so that side of the family has always been the family. And my grandfather also set aside money for me to go to college.
How was he getting Jews out of Europe?
He didn't sleep. He worked social systems, political systems, every sort of system he knew that to provide transportation and financing.
To get them here?
To get them someplace safe where they wouldn't be killed.
Okay. Because there were quotas already, you know, back to the 30s in the United States.
And he was fighting those quotas.
I see.
You know, wrangling with Roosevelt over this. I have his letters.
Anything touch on the St. Louis Symphony situation then? The boat with the refugees on it, or
I don't know if his letters touch on that. I'd have to go back and look. He was in Israel during the first Arab War. I remember seeing his letters there back to the State Department trying to get out because he thought there was a decent chance he was going to be killed.
You mean in the late 40s?
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
No, he died. He died my senior year in high school.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, why don't we take a short break? We're speaking with Mayor Dr. Philip. We're going to call him Honorable Mayor Professor Dr. Stoddard, Mayor Stoddard from South Miami in his fourth term. And in 2016, Politico named him one of the top 50 thinkers, doers, and visionaries transforming American politics. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. And we continue our visit with South Miami Mayor Dr. Philip Stoddard. Tell me, Mayor Stoddard, let's talk a little bit about a little more personal things. Your home, I'd like you to describe it for our listeners. It's all solar powered. You pay maybe $10 a month to FPL. You have a backyard with a fish pond, a couple kinds of fish in there, a lush vegetation. I'd like to see it sometime.
Well, you're welcome.
Describe
over.
Describe it.
You're welcome over. This had been a rental property. Nobody had really done much to maintain it, which was just perfect for us. So we knocked out the inside of the house and redid it. And then we started into the backyard, and the house is pretty far forward on the lot. So there was a lot we could do with it. And so we brought in big machines and dug out this big pond and then set to landscaping. And you plant for 3 years in Miami, and you spend the rest of your life ripping stuff out. Stuff just takes off. And so it's a forest.
You mean stuff you don't want or stuff you do want?
Stuff you do want, but it's so enthusiastic, it just grows like crazy. You
know. I did see pictures of it does look like a little jungle there.
Oh, it's a forest.
Yeah.
You know, and it's become a cypress swamp, so the back of the pond is lined with cypress trees, and the birds think it's a cypress swamp, so all of the swamp birds come down and do swamp things in it, and they go fishing and pick off little bugs off the surface, and you can swim in it. If you don't mind swimming with fish, which I don't, and water snakes, which I don't mind swimming with either. My wife's not so sure about water snakes, but I...
Well, you're the biologist. So.
Right.
Yeah, she reminds me. And there's certain things where she says, look, Phil, this is biology. You deal with it. Palmetto bugs in the kitchen. That's biology. That's my domain. There's also times when I would say to her, when we were redoing the house, she said, I'm getting tenure. I don't have time to play general contractor. And so I would... I said, okay, well, I'll do it. But there was times I was just totally over my head. I knew all the words. I didn't know what they meant together in that context. I'd say, Gray, I need to talk to my architect. And she'd put a pencil over her ear and she'd say, okay. And her demeanor would change completely. She'd go from my wife to my architect. And she would give me professional advice. And I'd say, okay, got it. And then she'd go back and say, what did I just say? And she'd say things like, yeah, move the door, spend the money, you won't miss it later. And she'd say, what did I say? It's okay, I got it. I know what to do.
So was it a challenge to install solar? Was it expensive, and does it pay for itself? Obviously, if you're paying $10 a month to FP&O.
$9.41.
$9.41, okay.
It's easy. It's dead easy. If you have a sunny roof and you don't have solar panels in your house, you're leaving money on the table. It pays for itself, and it pays you dividends over the life of the system. And it gets better than that because... The League of Women Voters came down to Miami-Dade County recently, and they said, we want to get solar purchasing co-ops started down here in Miami-Dade like they are in other places in the country. Is there anybody who will help with that? And I stuck up my hand, said, yes, I'll do it. And I knew I could do it because I sit on the board of the of the local PACE district. PACE stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy.
Ah, okay, that's what that is.
And we charge 0.1%, but we've done $250 million worth of business in the last year, and that little smidgen adds up to a little fund that we can use to promote green power to the next thing we're going to be working on. Vince Lago from Coral Gables and I are particularly interested in getting this going, is solar on affordable housing. Anyway, we had this little fund, and so we were able to write a grant to the Community Power Network out of Washington, D.C., which has a local branch called FL Sun, and they hired Jody Finver. And Jody is a force of nature, and she's going to be setting up these solar buying cooperatives across Miami-Dade County starting this summer. So watch for her.
So how will that work exactly?
So the way this works is that Jody will put out a notification to people in an area that they can join one of these co-ops. They'll get together, they'll get informed. She makes sure they learn how this works, and they'll set up a steering committee, which will then issue a request for proposals to local installers. They'll bid. The steering committee will select an installer, and then the people in that cooperative group can get good pricing at the group rate.
Okay.
And then the installer just goes down the line, ding, 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 and does the installations, saves the installer money because he or she doesn't have to spend time holding people's hands in their homes, and it gets better pricing to the participants.
In your case, how long did it take you to recoup the outlay?
Well, I look at it a little differently. Rather than saying I recoup it over this amount of time and then it's free energy after that, I look over the life of the system. And over the life of the system, it pays me about 8% return on investment. And I can't get a fixed return like that in my retirement portfolio. And if anybody out there knows how you can get 8% return on investment, tax-free, inflation-protected, please let me know, because I don't think you can find it anywhere else. And as FPL's rates go up, that 8% return to you goes up as well.
I was wondering, this is one thing, these co-ops sound like a great idea. Are there specific lending sources that you know of for homeowners who would like to switch to solar but don't have that initial money to lay out?
Well, the Green Corridor PACE program is one of those. So it's run by a company called Y-Green. You can look up, and it's like energy spelled backwards. But the Green Corridor does PACE financing. The way this works is that anything you do that provides energy efficiency in your house.
Yeah, a lot of projects.
This can be hurricane windows. This could be a new roof. This could be solar panels. This could be insulation. You pay it back on your annual tax bill rather than monthly interest payments and principal payments. So you do it once a year on the tax bill. There's two advantages to this. One is that if you sell the house, the next buyer typically picks it up. The other is it doesn't show up as debt on your balance sheets. So if you're...
And they approve the contractors also.
And the contractor has to be certified by the company. Yeah, you do seem familiar with it. There's an outfit called the Green Bank, which I think is going to be maybe opening up in this area. It's been useful to people up in Orlando. I mean, you can borrow money from a friend. You can do any sort of home loan you want, home improvement loan. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And different financing is better for different people, depending on your own situation.
I want to switch to climate change, if we may.
I hate climate change.
Don't we all? You were very much ahead of your time. You call it your obsession with halting human-induced climate change. So how and when did you become obsessed with it? And why?
Early 90s. And how can you not? It's like watching a train wreck in slow motion. Once you recognize what's happening with the planet, you start wondering a few things. You know, one, are there any other planets? You know, like this is really bad. This is where we live. And how can you stop it? And then how bad can it get? And it's hard to stop. There are no other planets, and it can get really bad, sort of the answer. I used to lie awake at night thinking, when I was a kid, I'd worry about the next ice age. The next ice age is looking pretty good. But I was thinking for a while, boy, I hope this stuff isn't real. And as the science kept getting better and better developed, virtually all of the news coming in was bad news. It's just got, you know, it's gotten progressively worse in terms of what we understand is happening and going to happen.
Do you think has Tallahassee come around at all? I know last year in your frustration.
No, it's the short answer.
No, they haven't.
They're not paying attention.
So what can be done about that? What can we do about that?
About Tallahassee? Well, one thing is not to elect people who won't take a firm stand on it. Just ask them. That's your first question. What are you doing about, you know, climate change? And if they tell you, oh, I don't want to wreck the economy because it's too expensive to address climate change.
I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to address that.
I'm not a scientist, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was standing 4 feet from the governor when he said that. I'm not a scientist. I mean, what an answer. It's like, and it's particularly weird for him because he owns property on the Gulf in the Tampa St. Pete area. And he told a friend of mine that he's watched sea level rise working over his own property. He's perfectly familiar with it.
So why is he so resistant? Is it all about politics, economics?
It's all about campaign contributions.
So he wants campaign contributions from those who might be thwarted by efforts to
sure. If you
deal with.
If you make money in the carbon fuel extraction business, maybe you don't want a governor talking about climate change and sea level rise in Florida. But, you know, it's still going to happen, and there will be greater loss and suffering for people failing to address it sooner.
Because South Florida is such a ground zero for sea level rise, what do you foresee happening down the road with, say, property values and people not being able to live here anymore?
Or not being able to get insurance?
Well, you just described it for me pretty well. I mean, that is what's going to happen. So one of the things that's going to happen is that people will be unwilling to issue 30-year mortgages or unable to take them out. If you're required to have flood insurance and the mortgage lenders want you to have it, the value, well, imagine, what would it cost to insure a property against something that's inevitable? Well, you can't get insurance against inevitable things. So if sea level rise is guaranteed, then there's no insurance against that. What they can insure you for is the chance events, the unlikely events. And so, you know, is there going to be a storm this year that's going to make the flooding worse? That they might insure you for. But for the steady increase of sea level rise, there is no insurance and there can be no insurance. So ultimately, the cost of flood insurance in Miami goes to the entire value of the property because it's underwater.
And whether inland or not.
Yeah. It's a pretty flat state. So there's the last time we had this much carbon in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, we're at 410 parts per million right now. The last time we had this much CO2 in the atmosphere was 5 million years ago, and the sea level was about 100 feet higher. That was Florida.
100 feet, yeah.
About 100 feet, yeah. So look at your property, look at your house, and tell me what your life will be like with 100 feet of water on you, because that's where we're going with the amount of carbon we have right now.
Is there time, though, to reduce carbon and make a meaningful impact?
Yes, is the short answer. If you look at the recent NOAA report that came out in January, somewhere around page 20-something, they've got a graph. And it shows sea level up to the present, and it's one line because that's what's happened. And this is global sea level, not local. Global sea level sort of gone up at about 3 millimeters a year. And then it looks like a prism splits the light. You get all these different colored lines coming up off of the present date. And those different rates of sea level rise correspond to different amounts of carbon release. And so there's the upper curve is the business as usual curve. If we do nothing to change what we're doing, we get the steepest curve. And so they're now projecting about 8.5 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, which is 83 years away. So kids born today would see 8.5 feet of sea level rise globally if we do nothing to change how we're managing carbon pollution right now. And then the lower lines correspond to reducing carbon emissions by some amount.
So we could still make a difference. There's still a chance to make a difference. do you have any aspirations to run for higher office? I know you didn't have aspirations to be mayor in the first place, but do you aspire to higher office? Would you do it?
I won't say that I won't. I've been getting a lot of calls recently, especially since Congresswoman Ross Layton decided not to run again. I was getting calls before, but yeah, I was getting calls this morning even, and I have not committed myself to a path yet, I think is the simplest answer. I hadn't projected on becoming mayor either, so I just, you know, I can't say that I won't, but it's not, I don't yet have a plan for doing it.
If you did, where would you start? Would you go for the state legislature or Congress?
Well, Mike Grunwald has...
You could still go for the county commission.
Well, Mike Grunwald has suggested I run for either Congress or governor. And he's a senior political writer for Politico magazine.
Wrote the great book on the Everglades.
The Swamp, wonderful book. He suggested at one point that I run for Congress. I said, Congress? He says, yeah. He says, watching the U.S. Congress is like watching a kid's soccer match. Everybody's running after the same ball, leaving the rest of the field open. He says, you can pick your area, and I know what area you'd pick, right. And you almost have it to yourself. And that's a pretty attractive idea, that if I were in the U.S. Congress, that I would really focus on climate issues, and I would focus on climate issues that I think ought to get bipartisan support in a somewhat rational world, at least.
Right.
And the real key thing that we ought to be doing today is a carbon tax. The big banks say we need a carbon tax. The big oil companies say carbon tax is the way to go. The environmentalists say carbon tax is the way to go. The economists say a carbon tax is the way to go. And carbon tax is great because it returns money back to the people. And we can decide how to spend it. You could give people a break on other taxes if you wanted to. Or you could put the money back into investments in public infrastructure. We know that our bridges are going to collapse. You could make it less expensive for people to get solar energy. You could provide the battery backup systems that solar energy is going to require using the monies from the carbon taxes. There's a whole lot of ways to reinvest that money back into society and make people's lives better.
But how do you get it passed?
Well, again, let's go back and look at who's behind it. When ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, says we need a carbon tax, you know, that's reasonable credibility right there. I mean, he's... our current president seems to think well enough to put him in charge of the State Department. And then Wall Street banks like Goldman Sachs think a carbon tax is a good idea. Economists do. You know, and they're aligned with the environmentalists. Now, wait a second. How many times do you see the environmentalists and the oil companies saying the same thing? Carbon tax. It's really clearly the way to go. And with all these different forces aligning on it, it's hard to think of a good reason not to go that direction.
We're speaking with Dr. Philip Stoddard. He's in his fourth term as mayor of South Miami. If you want to join in the conversation, our number is 1-800-743-9576. Excuse me, 1-800-743-WLRN. Our email is radio@WLRN.org. I'd like to move on to the Zika virus situation. First of all, is that here to stay? Is that going to recur? Do they predict that we're going to get that same mosquito and it's going to again bring the Zika virus to South Florida?
Well, the mosquito is here. It's the people who bring the virus here.
Ah, okay. So the...
Mosquitoes are homebodies. They kind of stick around. People move around. And Zika is a particularly tricky one because 80% of people who get Zika don't have any symptoms, and so they feel perfectly fine. You know, you could have Zika, I could have Zika, Joe could have Zika, we could, you know, you would have no idea. And you go about your daily lives, a mosquito bites you, big deal, you brush it off maybe. And then it bites the pregnant lady down the street who gets the same thing, and possibly her fetus gets damaged by it. I mean, what we don't know is whether there's neurological problems in adult humans. And it's not out of the question. There's been studies done on cultured brain cells that shows that the Zika virus can kill brain cells in culture from adult humans.
Wasn't it saying it was responsible for Guillain-Barré syndrome?
Yes.
Okay.
A neurodegenerative condition that's rarely fatal, but particularly unpleasant. It can take a couple years to recover. But there was also a study done in mice where they infected the adult mice with the Zika virus, and it killed stem cells in the brain, neural progenitor cells. And I love those cells. I mean, those are the cells that are going to replace the brain cells I'm killing with politics. And so I don't want to lose that capacity. And we don't know what it means. Does that mean that you maybe go senile at a younger age because you're not able to replace brain cells in your hippocampus, for instance? So it's a worrisome thing. It should be a worrisome thing for everybody. Now, this mosquito is an African mosquito. It was a forest mosquito. It moved into the villages and became adapted to people. It's sort of the perfect human parasite. And it moved all over the world with the ships. We have it. It's over much of the United States at this point, at least the temperate areas. And it's here. So what's to keep it, Zika, from coming back? Nothing really.
So what was the controversy? You were against the spraying of what they were using. You were saying it was ineffective. Was that it? Why was there a controversy against what you were saying, with what were saying?
Let's go back over this. I mean, we got slammed by Zika. It caused a lot of panic. It caused a huge economic hardship in Miami-Dade County. I mean, the visits to the airport were down, the cruise ships were down, the hotels were down. It had a significant economic effect. This is the first time that the Public Health Service in the United States has advised pregnant women not to go to U.S. city. I mean, this is a big deal.
Right.
You know, we do not want this virus becoming endemic here. And that's what it was threatening to do. So everybody was fully correct to be as concerned as possible. Now, there comes politics come back into it because everybody wants, you know, they want to look tough on crime. They want to look tough on bugs. They want to look tough on diseases. So they said, pull out the arsenal. Let's use the toughest, meanest, strongest insecticides we got. We're not going to mess around with this thing. This is so serious. And everybody was looking over their shoulder. They were looking at the press, and they pulled out everything they had. And if there was advice to use an insecticide, darn it, we're going to use it. We've got to get this virus down. And it's a serious virus. It is absolutely a serious virus. And some folks say, oh, maybe Zika's not so bad. No, Zika is that bad. It can produce devastating effects. You don't mess around with this virus. In that respect, folks absolutely got it right to take it seriously. Then the question is what you use. And this is when you need to use the best science. And the United States has lost sight of controlling this mosquito. This mosquito was a serious problem. This is the yellow fever mosquito that, you know, wiped out a lot of people in the United States and other places in the world. And we had dengue in Florida. We had yellow fever in Florida. We eliminated them all. And we didn't do it so much with insecticides as with controlling the mosquito. The sanitary landfill movement is what allowed us really to take dengue out of South Florida with a final use of insecticides sort of strategically to knock them down. And the problem is this mosquito pulls off somewhere in the range of 15, maybe as many as 20 generations a year. It can out-evolve anybody and anything. It takes a mosquito about 10 generations to evolve behavioral resistance strategies. That's really fast. And so we've got a mosquito that now is fitting in 15 generations per year. They can out-evolve anything you throw at them.
So if it's this NALED, which is that insecticide they were using, it can become immune to that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And they can detoxify it. And there's an enzyme that they modify to evolve resistance. So initially, the county pulled out their standard arsenal that they use against mosquitoes, and they've been fighting salt marsh mosquitoes for a long time. The good thing about fighting salt marsh mosquitoes is that the salt marsh mosquitoes are really obnoxious. I mean, they used to suffocate cattle. They're that bad. And if you've been out in coastal areas at night, you know they fly at you with all the charm of a nail gun. I mean, they're just obnoxious. They don't carry that much in the way of human disease. They're just really unpleasant. And so we hate them. And so the county was all geared up for fighting these mosquitoes. The problem is, every time they do a spray for salt marsh mosquitoes, they also expose Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, to the same insecticides. And it's like a stamp collector. It collects resistance genes. And so when they finally got around to looking at insecticide resistance at the end of the season, University of Florida Entomological Lab did this. They discovered that our local Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are as resistant as the most resistant mosquitoes in Puerto Rico to the insecticides that the county has traditionally used. Not just the specific ones, but the entire families of insecticides. So the pyrethroids, which have sort of been our staple since mosquitoes evolve resistance to DDT, our mosquitoes are pretty resistant to pyrethroids, it turns out. Now, the county sort of discovered this, incidentally, when they were fighting them in Wynwood. They noticed that the pyrethroids were not doing much. They also discovered that a larvicide called BTI was working. And it's a really, you know, it's almost our wonder drug when it comes to fighting mosquitoes. BTI is a soil bacterium, and it has four different toxins inside it. You have to eat it in order for the toxins to affect you. And you have to be a mosquito. It only affects a small group of the Diptera, the two-winged fly order. It affects some mosquitoes, not even all of them, and some gnats. It doesn't kill butterflies, doesn't kill moths, doesn't kill honeybees, doesn't kill beetles, doesn't kill spiders. It's really specific. And because it has four different toxins in it, it's very hard for mosquitoes to evolve resistance to it. It's great. It's like, who made this for us? It's wonderful stuff. So the county began using this in Wynwood. And their data showed it actually worked. And it doesn't make the mosquitoes all disappear overnight because it just kills larvae. But what they saw in the data set, or at least what I saw in their data set, was a lovely decrease in the mosquito population. Now, they were throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at these mosquitoes. And so it was hard to say exactly what stopped the transmission of Zika in the Wynwood neighborhood because they used everything at once. It wasn't a controlled experiment.
Including the chemicals.
Yeah. But they did use this BTI outside of the immediate Wynwood neighborhood where they had Zika, and it knocked down the mosquitoes there too. So we knew that BTI worked. And so the problem occurred when Zika popped up on Miami Beach. What would you want to apply in Miami Beach? The pyrethroids that you'd already discovered weren't working, the BTI that was working, and we can get to nail it in a minute, and you would think they would want to use BTI. When they used pyrethroids for about a month or so, and it didn't work. And then they brought the BTI in, and lo and behold, it did the same magic as it had in Wynwood. And so I would have used BTI sooner. Now, it does require specialized hardware to distribute it. You can't use the same stuff to spray it as you can with the insecticides they were already using, and that might have been part of the reason for the delay. But the county has learned a lot from last year's season. And I'm actually very happy to report that they figured out what worked, and they're going to be back in with BTI. In fact, what they've started doing now is going into some of the commercial districts and applying BTI proactively to keep the mosquito populations down before Zika gets established. And I think that's very wise. So as critical as I was of how they handled the beach situation with the delays in using BTI last season, I'm equally pleased on the other side now that they're getting ahead of the curve and starting to apply BTI, including in South Miami. So I think people learned a fair bit from that lesson.
That was the crux earlier on, that you didn't want them spraying the city that you represent with those pesticides.
Well, I didn't want them spraying with insecticides that was going to take out our natural controls. I mean, a spider eats 10 mosquitoes a day. And so you don't want to be knocking out your spider population because they're natural insecticides, essentially.
And it was also killing bees, butterflies, okay.
And it's persistent. You know, it also gets into the waterways and it kills shrimp and it kills fish and, there's other side effects. Whereas the BTI is pretty good. And there's other methods that we're looking into now that may be, even more effective and, again, don't have those side effects that I'm so concerned about.
We're speaking with Mayor Philip Stoddard in his fourth term as mayor of South Miami. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and get your calls and emails. Stay with us.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Byrne, and Dr. Philip Stoddard. He's the City of South Miami mayor. Dr. Stoddard, I want to briefly return to sea level rise again on a local level and on a more immediate level. the pumping stations that Miami Beach is using, something like 40 of them, to try and return that water deep within the earth. Is that something that can work?
Well, I didn't think they were putting them deep beneath the earth. I thought they were pumping the water out into the bay. They don't have injection wells yet.
I believe that was talked of, at least.
It has been talked of. It was decided it was expensive. I mean, right
of course
now,
it would be.
Right now, what they're doing is they're just pushing the water out in the bay, which has been a little problematic, and people didn't anticipate some of these problems. I mean, they had to move quickly, and they did move quickly. And when you do that, then you discover all of the weird stuff that happens. And the first surprise, I mean, when they did, I thought it was just going to be regular bay water. Bay water comes in, you pump bay water out. What the scientists saw was the bay water was full of silt. And this is weird. It's like, where's that coming from? And then I realized, essentially, the tides are back flushing the radiator. So all of the water that comes in historically has come from rain and it goes down. And now when you've got water coming from below and going up, it's taking all the sediment and silt, et cetera, that has been lodged in the rock and is dislodging it.
Would you explain that again?
Yeah. So you know how, what it means to backflush a radiator?
Yeah.
So all the gunk that's in your radiator, when you run the water through the wrong direction, all that gunk comes loose.
Okay.
And it's the same thing with our oolitic limestone rock. It's got all the sediment lodged in it from one-way water flow, i.e. down from rain. And now you've got water from the king tides pushing it up, and it takes all the sediment and loosens it, and it's floating around now. So if you pump that back out, you've got a whole lot of stuff that you weren't expecting to
in
have.
The bay.
And
in
the
bay.
But the rock is permeable, so mm-hmm. how can you pump it out when it's sort of like a sponge?
Well, the water's coming up from below into the streets. And
right.
So you're taking, you know, you dig a hole in the sidewalk or next to the sidewalk, and it fills up with salt water, and you pump that out. And on the face of it, it's a good idea to pump that water out of your streets because it's rusting everybody's cars out.
A lot of people think there's broken water mains there, and they're not.
Well, no, that's a different issue as
storm
well.
Water.
It's not water mains. It's not water mains problem. There was some discussion of that, and everybody knew it was salt water, anybody who checked the salinity.
That's what I meant, though, that people were thinking that it was water mains when actually it was rising levels.
Everybody I talked to said, this is salt water. It's not coming out of the water main.
Groundwater.
They knew it was salt water. At least everybody on the beach I talked to knew it was salt water. Mm-hmm. It's not very hard to tell. And I'll tell you, a lot of people who discovered that there was human gut bacteria in it were really unhappy that they tasted it. And that was the next discovery, was that along with the sediments that were getting pushed up, there was a lot of human gut bacteria in it. And that told us something that, again, we shouldn't have been surprised at in retrospect, but it's the wisdom of hindsight. And that is that if you've got leaky septic tanks and broken sewer pipes, normally they drain down into the ground. And when the water's going up, hey, their contents come up too. And so that was a wake-up call to elected leaders in coastal communities. I guess we got to fix these leaky sewer pipes and leaky septic tanks. And it's not just restricted to Miami Beach. That's just where they did the first tests, because that's where the pumps were installed. But this same process is happening all along the coasts. So, you know, City of Miami is going to have to face the same thing. And all
so what would be a remedy for this?
Fixing your sewer pipes so they don't leak.
Right.
It seems simple enough.
But what about the silt that's also the sediment?
So you have to create some kind of settling ponds. I mean, so you can either inject the water down into the ground, which was what you asked about initially, injection wells. It costs more. You've got to pressurize it to push that water down. Or you've got to create some kind of vortex filter that catches, you know, separates out the silt before you put the water back in. And you're actually required to do something like this because the Clean Water Act doesn't allow you to have these point discharges of pollution. So we have to do this. But it was an unanticipated complication. So I don't fault Miami Beach for having moved quickly and decisively to put these pumps in to get salt water out of the streets. I think that was a smart thing to do. We got surprised by some of the things that happened. It was all done very fast without a lot of study. And if they'd taken longer and they'd studied it, they would have discovered these things, but they were out of time and they had to move. And so they're just figuring this out as they go. They're doing experiments. You know, I'm a scientist. I do experiments. I expect things to go wrong. And this is something the public has to understand, is that when you've got governments taking a lead and doing experiments, expect some things to go wrong, but thank them for at least doing the experiments and finding out. You know, we're going to try a lot of different things, and some things are going to work better than others.
How are you managing the growth and development and traffic problems and congestion in South Miami? I mean, it's a problem throughout South Florida. We know that. But are you doing things to manage that or to...
Well you have to, this is a great question. So we're shifting gears here away from sea level rise to urban life in general. Miami-Dade County's development patterns are the problem. Look at where the big development has happened. They began building multi-unit families, dwellings and townhouses where? Out in West Dade. Is there good transit out to West Dade? No. How about in Homestead? They've rolled houses out over the farmlands and in South Dade as well. Lots and lots of development down in Cutler Bay as well. And all these people come up for the jobs in the eastern side and the central part of the county. And they take cars because there is no good public transit. So guess where your traffic is coming from? It's all coming from the peripheral areas where they've been building housing without any plan.
The same is happening in the Northwest.
Yep.
Plus this mega mall business.
Mega malls. Yeah. Again, but why would you put your people way the heck out to the west and the south when you know where the job centers are? And so it's this mismatch between the job centers and the residential centers that has caused the traffic. In South Miami, there was a multifamily housing constructed, 300 and something units, and it's half a block from the Metrorail. There is zero traffic around this building. And the reason is that everybody takes Metrorail. They moved there specifically so they could take the Metrorail. It's called Valencia Apartments. And I went there, you know, they've got 113 units break. I thought, oh man, that's going to be just like traffic hell. It's not. Mm-hmm. You go there rush hour, it's like a ghost town. And you see people walking and biking out of there. So the solution to all of these problems is to make it possible for people to live near the transit corridors. And as soon as you do that, they discover it's way more convenient to take transit. You can sit and look at your phone or read a book or something and get to work. And why would you possibly want to spend your time in a car when you can have a reasonably fast and pleasant experience in transit without any headaches? And so that's how you do it. And then there's the question of what's called the last mile problem. How do you get from the transit center to where you live? If it's within a quarter mile, everybody walks. If it's within half a mile, many people walk. And if it's within a mile, people take their bikes and there's bike racks.
Okay, on that note, we've run out of time. We've been speaking with Mayor Philip Stoddard in his fourth term in South Miami. Since 1992, he's been a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at FIU, Florida International University. And in 2016, Politico named him one of the top 50 thinkers, doers, visionaries, and visionaries transforming American politics. We thank you very much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure.
Our pleasure.
That wraps up today's edition. Our program was produced by Polly Landis. Technical direction from online features producer Jason Zabka. Richard Ives is lead producer. And it's easy to download free audio archives from our website. That's WLRN.org. We also have the iTunes podcast as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page. The downloads are great to link to friends or relatives. And so we turn towards tomorrow's topical currents. We feature acclaimed tech law pioneer, attorney Mark Grossman. It's always a fascinating hour. Tomorrow we'll get tips on negotiation skills, having interaction where each party goes away at least a little bit happier. We'll also be taking your calls, of course. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.